Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Anna Staver. Unpaid medical bills can tank your credit score, keeping you from buying a home, qualifying for a car loan, or getting a decent interest rate. A new rule from the Biden administration would keep those medical debts off your credit reports. Washington Post National Health reporter Dan Diamond recently wrote about this latest effort by the Biden administration to address pocketbook issues. Dan, welcome to All Sides.
Anna, thanks for having me.
I want to begin by understanding how pervasive of an issue medical debt is for American credit scores. Do we have a sense of how many Americans have this kind of debt dragging down their score?
We do, though the problem has changed quite a bit over the past few years. Until a few years ago, medical debt represented more than half of all collections on credit reports. I think it was something like 57-58% of the collections on credit reports were medical debt related. And the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau estimated that about $88 billion of medical debt was collectively on credit reports. So big problem affecting about 45 million Americans. There have since been some efforts, even before what the Biden administration is doing, to make that less of a burden on Americans. The big credit reporting agencies, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion, they voluntarily adopted reforms about 2 years ago to make it less likely that medical debt would show up on credit reports. But still, there are 15 million Americans or so who do have this problem of medical debt weighing down their credit score and making it hard to go get a mortgage, to go get loans, to go about their lives beyond their healthcare needs.
Yeah, in 2022, I think they voluntarily eliminated debts less than $500, ones that had been like collections for under a year. So some, but you're right, there's still people out there. And I wonder, in all of your reporting, how are these debts impacting people? Like, can you tell us some of the stories that you heard from people across the country?
Well, I think what's interesting, Anna, is that the people who tend to be most affected by medical debt are going through life affected by other economic burdens too. These tend to be people who might have other financial woes, and the medical debt is contributing, but it might not be the sole problem. I spoke with Stanford professor Neil Mahoney, who had worked in the White House on economic issues, and he had found a surprising discovery that when medical debt was relieved for many Americans, it didn't help them with their broader financial challenges. But we did talk to, for the story, we did talk to people. My colleague Aaron Gregg spoke with someone at the Center for American Progress. This is a liberal think tank here in DC, who had said that years after getting bills when she was in college and then not being able to pay them because she missed those bills, her credit score was held back for years and years. And I personally experienced some of that. I missed a medical bill, very small one, years ago, and it followed me for a long time just because I didn't pay that $50 or whatever it was that I missed because I think it went to like my old address. So these are problems in big ways and small ways for many Americans. And I think the argument that the Biden administration has is it shouldn't be, that we should decouple healthcare needs from economic challenges.
Because it's not like choosing to buy a car. Sometimes you aren't choosing to get healthcare. You just absolutely need it.
Right. That's the argument that Vice President Harris made about a week and a half ago when they announced this initiative, that if you are trying to make decisions about your home, your car, your livelihood, you shouldn't be burdened by whatever bill followed you for the medical emergency you might have had 5 years ago.
So the CFPB says lenders could approve 22,000 more mortgages every year if this rule goes into effect, and credit scores for those with medical debts would rise 20 points on average. So that's not a small improvement. Like 20 points is not completely changing, but it would make a big difference, especially if someone is, say, you know, it bumps them from below 700 to above 700.
The argument that the Biden administration has made is this is really affecting the most vulnerable Americans. Mm-hmm. That if you look at the people who have medical debt on their credit reports, it is Black Americans, it is low-income Americans, it is people who already are having challenges getting that loan to buy a car or getting a mortgage to buy a house. So yes, those are the folks who would benefit the most. The counter argument here, Anna, is that there are some fears that people who are at risk of not paying medical bills might be at risk of broader failure to pay other bills. And that is something that has come up in the past week or so, that not everyone is excited about this proposal because they're worried that it would create incentives to not be compliant with bills that might be outstanding.
Yeah, because when they got rid of debts less than $500 in 2022, I get that, right? Like fundamentally, like the odds that that is going to get in, like that might impact your ability to pay a mortgage over 30 years doesn't feel as intense as like if you have $50,000 worth of medical debt, $100,000 worth of medical debt sitting out there. I do see that argument, perhaps, that, you know, is that going to impact your ability to pay for other things?
You're right that there is a fundamental difference between not paying the $250 medical bill and being able to pay a home mortgage. I think the argument that some collections agencies, for instance, who are very worried about this, they say that this could actually increase bad debt because if you had an incentive to pay before, because you were worried about the impact on your credit score, and now you're not worried, well, maybe those medical bills will stay out there longer. And their argument is, if you're a hospital, if you're a doctor, if you're a healthcare provider who's already not seeing compliance from your patients, this removes another lever to get compliance on that payment. But overall, there's a lot of enthusiasm, I think, for this measure, especially from consumer advocacy groups who call it overdue.
So this program would go into effect starting in January 2025, correct?
Not exactly. So
Okay.
the rule is not done. They proposed this rule this month, and then it has to go through the federal rulemaking process, which can last a while. They have to collect comments from the public for several months, and then they have to come up with a final rule, which means, Anna, this is going to take place after the election. So depending on what happens in the presidential election, this may never take effect. Donald Trump, when he was in the Oval Office for 4 years, did not crack down on medical debt. His campaign has not said anything on this issue. So it's possible that if President Biden loses re-election, this will not come to pass next year.
Yeah, that kind of answered my next question because it is an executive rulemaking and not a law. But in that vein, you know, the Biden administration has attempted in several different ways to forgive college loan debt, and that's gotten all tangled up in the court system. Do you think someone could challenge this rule in particular and tangle it up regardless of who wins?
That's an interesting question. Certainly. I mean, I cover healthcare and the number of legal challenges on virtually every healthcare rulemaking effort by the Biden administration are legion. We just covered the Supreme Court hearing an argument over medication abortion. The Supreme Court threw out that argument. They said that the plaintiffs didn't have standing, but we expect that there will be more challenges on medication abortion. So could there be challenges here as whatever opponent looks for a way to strike this down? Absolutely. But those challenges will not come until the rule is finalized. You can't really challenge a proposed rule.
Right, because we're even seeing on the rewriting of Title IX, like as it was getting finalized, then we started to actually see the challenges roll out to that. Because a lot of this, when we're talking about Title IX, healthcare, college loan debts, a lot of this is executive action. It is not a law enacted by Congress.
Right. I did see something since you're bringing up student loans, for instance. I did see something after our story published that polling shows Americans are more interested in forgiving medical debt as opposed to student loan debt, that this is more of a pocketbook issue, which I did not expect and I did not know before pursuing this reporting.
And speaking of voters across the country, this is all happening in an election year, and I wonder if there's been any criticism that this is an election ploy.
Interesting question. I think this has a little bit of history behind it. Kamala Harris, the vice president, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, had started working on this over a year ago. There was a press conference I remember late last year with the vice president where she talked about this. So it's not just a 2024 issue. This was a 2023, and I think even into 2022, they were working on trying to relieve medical debt burdens. That said, we are getting into the campaign season where there are a flurry of efforts all around healthcare, all around pocketbook issues like debt. So there will be more of this to come.
Yeah, and to be fair, you know, Democrats and progressives like Senator Bernie Sanders have attempted to eliminate medical debt or do these kinds of things for years.
Yes. And I spoke to Senator Sanders and his team about this because he had wanted this maximalist approach. He didn't want medical debt at all. And his office was pretty supportive of what the president and his administration are doing, saying that this is the right next step to try and crack down on medical debt as a burden.
So the proposal is undergoing public comment. When do you think a final official version will come out?
Good question. So, final comment or public comment will run through August. So, if listeners have something they'd like to weigh in on with respect to this, they can go online, find that rule, weigh in now. Most likely, this would be late this year, potentially early next year. The election will play a big role here again. There is a possibility that if President Biden loses, his administration may still try to put out a final rule. But in my experience, Anna, if there's a new administration that comes in, almost regardless of the topic, the new administration wants to put its stamp on virtually anything. So if President Biden loses, puts out a final rule, it may still be pulled back by an incoming Trump administration.
I gotcha. Just as even as simple as like we're going to take a look at this and potentially just reissue a final rule.
There have been a number of different things that I've worked on where the Biden administration got rid of the Trump effort, maybe something around like insulin, which has been in the news. The Trump administration did an insulin project. The Biden administration did away with that and pursued its own. Some things on opioid efforts, things that are more bipartisan, and yet each administration doesn't necessarily want to do what the last one had proposed.
You know, it feels like a little bit of a tenuous way to create new healthcare policy through these executive orders that like, but I have to assume that the odds of asking Congress to go ahead and make this a legal change, well, they're definitely not happening this year, but it would be a far more complicated effort.
Well, two things. First, this is rulemaking, federal rulemaking.
Yeah.
It's not an executive order. But it is something that does rest with each administration. And you're right, each administration can take a very different approach to how it wants to govern health policy, financial policy. Congress is probably not the avenue for big changes at the moment, just because Democrats control one house of Congress, Republicans control the other. And it is very, very difficult in a political election year, especially, to get major changes through. So I don't know if we would see, even in good times, major changes to, say, medical debt, given how the political parties have slightly different views of what they want here.
We've been speaking with Dan Diamond, who covers national health for The Washington Post. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thanks for having me, Anna.
Coming up, we all know we have to save for retirement and budget for groceries, but how much should we be spending on our exercise? That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Stever. We all know exercise is good for our physical and mental health, but how much should we budget for it? 5%, 10%, 20% of our take-home pay? Or should money really matter when it comes to finding the kind of movement that makes our hearts sing? Freelance writer Michaela Jameson has been reporting on how we prioritize fitness and how the millennial and Gen Z consumers in particular are changing the rules for investing in our health. Michaela, welcome to All Sides.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
All right, let's start at the beginning because, you know, the idea of making it a part of your budget, I think, is something that people have been doing for a long time. But it seems for millennial and Gen Z consumers, the percentage of their budget dedicated to their fitness is going up.
Yeah, that's right. And some of this is just a kind of an anecdotal matter. We have CEOs of gyms mentioning that there's a lot more Gen Z consumers, but there are discussions online and just in my own experience with people my age talking about how they're putting a larger proportion of their income into gyms. And also a lot of gyms and trainers are more expensive in general, too.
Yeah, everything seems more expensive these days. Like, don't even get me started on what it costs to get your hair done anymore.
Right. Some of this is just, it's more expensive no matter what.
Yeah. And I also think, how much of that increase has also come from this explosion of boutique fitness? I'm thinking, you know, CrossFit, Pilates, SoulCycle, Orange Theory, a lot of these boutique fitness gyms. I mean, we're talking $150 a month just to participate.
Right. Excuse me. Exactly. And some of the people I spoke with talked about the element of socialization coming out of the pandemic. They want to be around other people to work out. There's a motivational factor there. So you certainly could spend a little less to go to like a big box gym, your Planet Fitness, stuff like that. But some of those boutique studios where you get that motivational group factor, they just cost more, hundreds of dollars a month more.
Do we have any sense of how much a percentage of people's incomes are going to fitness?
It's hard because I think so much of this is a newer thing that hasn't been studied. Like we study how much people spend on rent or savings. There are people online who have said, like you mentioned, 5 to 10%. It's just kind of a ballpark figure. A few of the people I spoke to for this story that I wrote for the Washington Post, they are spending no more than 10% of their income, but these are also people that have higher incomes. So it still might be $400 a month, upwards of that. So this is kind of just the folks that are spending more, they're talking about why they are. And I think it is that wider feeling among Gen Z and millennials where it's more about that mind-body connection and that overall wellness and the mental health element too.
Yeah, it made me think of that old cliche that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And in some ways, it sounds like they are investing on the prevention side of things, right? Work out now to avoid more costly mental and physical issues down the line.
Sure. I think that can be a huge part of it. I've worked in gyms myself for quite a while. And if you look around, whether it's in person or on social media, there's just a lot of more information now about what can happen if you have a more sedentary lifestyle, how exercise can set you up for better health in the future. I think people are more attuned to those messages as well. So there can be this element of taking your health a little bit more into your own control, perhaps so that you don't have certain struggles later down the line. I think that's part of it, too, for sure.
Yeah, I also think part of it is, as strange as this may sound, is social media, because it has unlocked the ability to know what to do when you go to a gym, right? There's no sense of, if you want to find a routine or a set of routines, there's so many apps and like YouTube videos, and you could go follow someone's routine at the gym without ever having to be like worried about what to do once I get there.
I think that's it. I think people feel perhaps more empowered to know what to do, especially in a space like a weightlifting area, which is perhaps a little bit more complex than hopping on a treadmill. If you have a lot of influencers or social media accounts you're following that show you how to work out, especially as a beginner, I think people are kind of diving in a little bit more because there's more content to be seen, that's like how-to content.
One of the women in your article, her name was Emily. She's in Oceanside, California. And I got a little bit of sticker shock when I saw what she was spending. But she spends about $950 per month on a personal trainer and a gym membership. Now, she's a software engineer, so contextually, she has a high income. But she said it was about 15% of her after-tax income. And I thought that was interesting because she's sort of above that 5 to 10%.
Yeah. And she was one of the people who spoke about how the socialization is really important for her. She works from home, so she feels kind of isolated. She said that it's really the only thing that makes her feel that she can consistently keep her mood stable, feel good in general. And I think a lot of us are kind of struggling to find those outlets, especially again, coming out on the other side of the pandemic. Gyms and boutique fitness studios and training sessions are one of those things that might pop into our consciousness really quickly as, what can I do to make myself feel better? We all kind of know that exercise can help us feel better. I think a lot of people are just grabbing that, even if it is a large proportion of their income. Yeah.
Did you talk to anybody who maybe overspent on health and fitness?
I did. I talked to one young woman. She wanted to protect her anonymity for this story, but she said that she was spending $600 a month on personal training sessions, a gym membership, and also self-defense classes. And she was making around $55,000 a year.
Oh, my goodness.
So she told me that she, you know, put herself in debt for this. And the reason that she found that this was really important for her, the self-defense element was part of it because she was in a domestic violence situation. She wanted to learn how to protect herself. But she also said that she wanted to set herself up, to have an easier life in the future, like we were talking about. She lost some weight through going to the gym. She had some health conditions that she felt were improved through her exercise routine. So for her, she said she wanted to do whatever she felt she could to feel better now and set herself up to feel better in the future, even if that meant going into debt.
Yeah. I also wonder how much of this is also, you know, we talked about the rising cost of fitness and boutique fitness, which has become like increasingly popular in the last, I would say, 2 decades. But I also wonder how much of it is also this idea of like on-demand culture, right? Like, I want to find the classes that I want to take. Maybe I want to work with a personal trainer. I want that one-on-one touch. It seems like we almost have a willingness to spend more for what you're talking about with those kinds of connections. Because, you know, as somebody who used to do CrossFit, I mean, people joke it's a cult, but it, like, if you go at to the 6 a.m. class every Monday, Tuesday, every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, right? You meet people, you develop a community, you sometimes even develop friends.
Right, right. I mean, I completely agree. I've worked as a group fitness instructor. I've seen that community element myself, which is why I'm interested in stories like this. I think that sometimes it feels like group fitness spaces are one of those quote unquote third spaces that seem to be disappearing. It's where you can go besides your house or work. And for some of us, our house is our work now, where you can go to see the same people, like you said, have those recurring social ties that can lead to that sense of community. And I think for young people that just don't really have a strong sense of those third places in their lives now, gyms are everywhere. If you walk around most major cities, of course, if you're in a more rural space, it's different. But big cities, I can walk down my block and see like 10 different kinds of boutique fitness studios. So it might be where you turn if you're looking for like new friends, gym pals. Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if anybody talked with you about how a lot of insurance plans offer partial reimbursement for their gym memberships, perhaps savings on, you know, workout clothes, exercise equipment, like workout shoes. It seems like a lot of employers these days are offering subsidies for these programs.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't speak with anyone directly for this story about that, but you're absolutely right that a lot of employers are making it pretty obvious that they value that their employees take advantage of these types of things. I mean, having a gym membership is not going to be the magic bullet that solves all of like the prevention and all of the issues that we have with our health. But I do think it speaks to that kind of, if you're looking around for something to do to set yourself up to feel better, it's the thing in our culture that perhaps feels like it's the first step, or it's really abundant, or it's really obvious that we might start there. So there are companies too, and insurance policies, yeah, that are kind of encouraging people to have these memberships and get them for cheaper or even for free.
Yeah, I would say the dark side of that is like company weight loss competitions. Like sometimes those incentives get a little dark and weird.
Yeah, I don't think personally that that's something that sets people up for success, because not everyone's in a gym to lose weight. Weight loss doesn't necessarily have anything to do with it. You could want to go to a gym to get stronger, just to keep yourself where you're at. And that should be valuable, too. There should not be a weight loss component, in my opinion. And no one for this story was speaking about weight loss necessarily. They really were talking about the socialization, the mental health, the social connection, and just the atmosphere of being in a gym space as being really good for their kind of mental and physical health.
I wonder what the reaction has been to the article, because I like there is part of me that wonders if people reading it think, oh, you know, millennial and Gen Z people, adults, complain about not being able to buy a house and the increasing unaffordability of this, that, and the other, and then they're spending almost $1,000 a month on a gym and a personal trainer.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I anticipated that kind of reaction when I wrote it. And there's a long history of millennials and their spending getting made fun of, right, that we all know, with avocado toast and coffee and things. One of the young men that I spoke with for this story was saying that he used to spend a lot of money on going out, drinking, partying. He put his money in places that, looking back now, he's like, I spent all that money and nobody had an issue with it. But when I spend my money, $400 a month on a gym, people kind of balk at it. So I can understand kind of giving the side eye to anyone that's putting themselves into debt for something of kind of their own choosing that maybe seems like an extraneous expense. But the feeling here seems to be people spend a lot of money on a lot of things that aren't, you
know,
necessities.
We all have a thing that we spend too much money on.
Exactly. And so for these people, I think for some of them, it is actually within their budget, they feel. But even for the people that are going into debt, I think that they just think of it as this is the priority for me right now, and it's worth it, and it's what I have to do at any cost.
Yeah, one of the women in your article, if I'm remembering correctly, said that she chose to live in like a smaller apartment further away from the city center. Like she made financial choices in order to make this part of her budget.
Right. She was saying, you know, I haven't bought new clothes. I moved to a different place. She really wanted to make this work. So even though she did have to go into debt for this, it demonstrated that she was doing what she could to eventually come out of that debt, make this work for herself. It's just something that in this immediate moment, she felt was the best choice for her health. And so anytime we look at other people's spending, I think it's pretty easy to kind of, we take it, you know, it's like a mirror of ourselves, like, oh, what are we spending money on? But the feeling here, I think, for people, and one of the experts I talked to, Natalia Petralza, she wrote a book called Fit Nation. She was saying that for a lot of people, this is just smart spending. Like if millennials are getting, you know, talked about how they spend too much money on this, that, and the other, is spending too much money, quote unquote, on your physical health, is that really so bad? I think these people don't think it is. I think they think it's smart.
Yeah, I've heard of people with like $900 a month car payments, and somebody else might turn a snide eye at that and be like, why would you do that?
Right, right, right.
No, you know, I have to ask, and I don't know if you have the answer to this, but is the increased spending on fitness being equally done by men and women, or is there sort of a gender divide in who's making these kinds of investments?
No, it's an interesting question. I didn't look at that for this particular article, but I have seen a little bit of information survey data and things about boutique fitness studios, like you were mentioning earlier. More women tend to join those kind of studios. It depends on the studio, like CrossFit gyms might be an outlier, different types of exercise gyms. But as far as group fitness, what I can tell is that more women tend to join those type of spaces. Not entirely sure why that is yet. Maybe that's a story for another time. But I think so much of this is kind of a newer phenomenon. Like we're just kind of now looking, especially again, coming out of pandemic where so many gyms were closed and the fitness industry got shaken up so much. I think now we're just starting to look around and say, what are we doing with gyms now? What are people spending? Who is going to gyms? I think we're going to see more information about this kind of thing coming out in this moment.
Yeah, I also think it's been interesting to watch the secondary market for things like Peloton bikes and other home fitness equipment that seems like it really had a moment during the pandemic. And then people are like, nah, actually, I think I like going to spin class with other humans.
Right, right. I mean, I can say for myself, working from home, there came a point where I was like, I got to get out of here. I think some of that is happening too, for sure. And I taught group fitness classes, like I said, and I taught cycling. And so when everybody got a Peloton, that shifted who was going to those classes. And now, like you said, we're seeing that people are like, all right, I'm over the Peloton. I'm going to go somewhere else. So all of this stuff, I think, is going to continue to shift and change into a new place, you know, in the next 5 years. It's going to be really interesting.
I know that you focus primarily on millennial and Gen Z consumers, but I'm wondering if you've looked at older Americans, perhaps even like boomers, because there are a lot of supplement programs like on Medicare that have gym programs for seniors. And I wonder if their spending is going up as well. Is it heightened in the millennial and Gen Z? I'm just sort of wondering if we're all having a moment rather than like millennials in particular.
I think that just because of how expensive everything is, like, yes, if you just kind of look at the raw data of are people spending more money on gyms, I mean, yeah, probably, if gyms are getting more expensive. I think this story really was interested in the idea that perhaps younger generations are more willing to even go into debt for fitness. And, you know, that phenomenon, I'm not entirely sure how that breaks out across generational cohorts, but you bring up an interesting point about older folks. You know, they might be spending the same, but they're getting some of their spending subsidized, right? It's not coming right out of their income, or perhaps some of the people that have employer-sponsored insurance, they might be getting their gym membership, you know, at a reduced rate. These folks were talking about like, so my money coming right out of my paychecks, this is what I'm putting towards fitness. So like I said, I think it'll be interesting to see if there's any more data or surveys or research coming out about, you know, how you compare these things across everyone. There are some major like fitness organizations that do these quarterly or annual reports on gym spending. So I have my eyes on those kind of things too, to see like what happened in 2024. How did this break out?
I guess my final question, you know, is that we were talking about people spending $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 a month on gyms. Was there any recognition of like, I guess, their ability to do so, to have that option, to make those choices?
One of the women that I spoke to, you know, she said in the quote that she gave, I think, was she almost had sticker shock about her own spending. She said, it is kind of ridiculous that I spend on a gym what some people spend on rent. I think there is an awareness of how pricey this is. And I think some people are totally willing to feel the blowback from people that are shocked by what they spend. So that self-awareness is there. I think the other attitude, though, is kind of, hey, this is my priority. Everybody has different priorities when it comes to spending. And so what interested me about this story in general is, why is it a priority for some people to spend this on gyms? And I think it just comes back to physical and mental health. It's just huge. And this is the best and easiest way for them to do it based on their income.
That was journalist Michaela Jameson. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Anna.
Coming up, we're going over how to stay healthy as the temperatures climb. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. It's hot outside this week, but more than being hot, we're actually stuck in a heat dome. Most people living in the Northeast and Midwest are in this bubble of high temperatures, and we're going to be stuck here at least until the end of the week. Here to remind us all how to stay safe in extreme heat is Ashley Novak, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service's Wilmington, Ohio office. Welcome to All Sides.
Good morning.
Good morning. So first things first, what is a heat dome and how is it different than a heat wave?
So a heat dome can occur when you have a large area of high pressure. While low pressure systems are generally associated with stormy conditions, high pressure is more associated with dry conditions. And that is because the air is actually sinking. So this sinking air compresses and warms, creating that heat dome. The dome of high pressure typically is associated with more sunshine too, because of that sinking air, and therefore this heats the surface even more. So sometimes the steering pattern of the winds in the atmosphere and the strength of the area of high pressure are such that these heat domes can remain in place for an extended period, thus leading to a heat wave, which is a period of abnormally hot weather that can vary in length of time. And what makes this heat wave particularly dangerous beyond what the exact temperatures would suggest is the early arrival of the heat in the summer season, the persistence of this heat over multiple days, and the light winds.
Yeah, because if you look, you know, anybody who's looked at their phone or a weather report, it's like, you know, every day it's like 95, 96, 95, 96 all week. You're like, ugh, it's going to be hot and it's going to be hot all week.
Yes, this one definitely has an extended period of heat and is expected to last all week.
So for people who have to be outside or doing work, because I've seen a lot of construction going on, because traditionally at this time, I mean, it's warm, but it's not like 96 to 100 degrees warm. So for people who have to work outside, what are the extra precautions that they should really be thinking about right now, especially if they weren't planning to be working in 95, 96 degree heat?
So for those that have to work outside, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or the OSHA, they recommend protective measures for outdoor work. So they have certain things in mind, such as acclimating workers starting their first day in the heat and after extended periods of absences, providing shade for outdoor work sites, scheduling work either earlier in the day or later in the day, using work rest schedules, and especially limiting strenuous work, such as carrying heavy loads, and use relief workers when needed. You know, it's really important to drink water often as well, and to know the symptoms, prevention, and emergency response to prevent heat-related illnesses and death. One other important thing is to also check those weather forecasts ahead of time to be better prepared.
Let's talk about some of those heat-related illnesses. I think, you know, dehydration is probably the first one, and it's the one probably most of us experience. And so I think, like, you know, early symptoms are usually what, like thirst, dizziness, a little bit of confusion?
Yeah, so there are a lot of heat risks that come with the higher temperatures. And heat can have a very taxing effect on the body, especially when you have this cumulative effect over several days, is what we're seeing with this event. During these periods of hot and humid weather, your body's ability to cool itself is challenged. And so when the body heats too rapidly to cool itself properly, or when too much fluid is lost through dehydration or sweating, the body temperature actually rises, and you may experience one of these heat-related illnesses. And that can be anything from heat cramps to heat exhaustion or heat stroke, which can lead to death even. And heat actually was the leading cause of weather-related fatalities in 2023, with over 200 fatalities in the United States. So some of these warning signs that you can look for to make sure that you aren't having something where you're getting sick from the heat, the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention actually provide a list of warning signs and symptoms of heat illness. So some of the first things might be heat cramps is for the first related sign, which you can have, yeah, heat exhaustion or, that may lead to heat exhaustion or heat stroke. So if you have this, they recommend applying firm pressure on the cramping muscles or gently massage to relieve the spasm, and drink sips of water unless if there's nausea, and then stop having water, and seek medical attention if the cramps longer than 1 hour. But that's really, you know, the lowest level. Then we get into heat exhaustion, which is something that you really don't want to experience, where there might be heavy sweating, weakness, tiredness, that cool, pale, clammy skin, fast or weak pulse, muscle cramps, dizziness, nausea, vomiting, headache, and fainting. So these are all signs that you might be experiencing heat exhaustion. So if you have this, or you come across someone that has heat exhaustion, you want to go to a cooler environment, especially a well air-conditioned room if you have it. Loosen your clothing, apply cool, wet cloths, or sit in a cool bath, sips of water. But you want to seek medical attention if there's vomiting or those symptoms last for longer than an hour. But unfortunately, if it gets to the next level with heat stroke, that heat stroke, you might have throbbing headache, confusion, body temperature rising above 103. You might even have fainting or loss of consciousness. And so again, you want to go to the air-conditioned environment and cool cloths, but don't give fluids at that point. Use a fan if the heat index temperature are below the high 90s, but a fan can actually make you hotter at higher temperatures. But heat stroke is a severe medical emergency, and delay can be fatal. So it's important to call 911 or get the victim to the hospital immediately with that.
Yeah, and there's, and then, and older adults and young children are particularly vulnerable to those more serious complications. So definitely keep an eye on your small children.
Yeah, there's definitely groups that are more sensitive to that extreme heat. And there's a wide variety of people that this could include. You had mentioned, children, and but these also include pregnant individuals, newborns, children, elderly, and those with chronic illnesses. Extreme heat events have even been shown to be associated with adverse birth outcomes. And newborns are sensitive to the heat because their ability to regulate body temperature is really limited. And that's sort of the same with young children and infants as well, because their bodies are less able to adapt to heat than adults. And older adults, especially those with pre-existing diseases, take certain medications or living alone or have limited mobility, are also at a higher risk. And people with chronic medical conditions. So it's important for everyone to take appropriate precautions during heat, but especially these vulnerable populations.
You know, something I didn't think about until I saw actually a post online is about how to keep your pets safe during severe heat, because their paws, particularly if you live in, say, downtown Columbus, like their paws on asphalt and concrete and sidewalks, like they can get burned from just going for a walk. So you have to be cognizant also of your pets.
Yes, you definitely have to be aware of your pets as well. As you mentioned, pavement temperatures can get very hot very quickly. So it's during hot weather, it's best to keep your pets at home. But another area that, in addition to pavement temperatures, is car safety as well. It's never safe to leave a child, a disabled person, or a pet in a locked in a car. Each year, unfortunately, dozens of children and an untold number of pets, they're left in parked vehicles and they die from hyperthermia, which occurs when the body absorbs more heat than it can handle. So hyperthermia can occur even in mild days where temperatures are in the 70s. So we think of these really hot time frames like this, where the temperatures are in the 90s and the heat index values are over 100. But with car situations, it can be dangerous at a lot lower temperatures. And that the temperature can really rise rapidly to dangerous situations for children, pets, and even adults. In fact, animals can even die of heat stroke within 15 minutes in a car. And some people think cracking the windows might help, but cracking the windows don't help. The inside still gets dangerously hot. And if you see a pet in an unattended vehicle, don't leave until the problem is resolved. But really, the takeaway message from all this, during hot weather, it's best to keep your pets at home in a cool location.
Yeah, I think anybody who's ever opened a car door after leaving it outside for a couple hours and was like, whew, that feels like an oven. It's because it quite literally is inside. Like, I've seen those viral videos of people that have like baked cookies or fried an egg inside of their car just to demonstrate how hot it's getting inside the vehicle.
Yeah, and it just really doesn't take that long, which is really scary, and wanting to make sure that you keep everyone safe, from, children, adults, pets, everyone.
So weather-wise, we've been talking a lot about the effects of the heat, but weather-wise, when are we going to get a break in this heat dome? When is it going to be over?
So we are expecting 90-degree temperatures to last for a little while longer yet. We do have a cold front that is coming through on Sunday, which will offer a brief, slight reprieve, with temperatures being able to drop below that 90-degree mark on Monday. But by the time we get back into Tuesday, there's already that potential for 90-degree temperatures to return to the area.
Oh, my God. So it sounds like a little bit of a reprieve, and then we're right back up there again. It feels, I don't know, maybe it's my imagination, but are we getting a lot hotter earlier than we normally do? This feels a little early.
So that is one of the signs that this makes this heat wave more dangerous, is because it is earlier than some of the other heat waves that we have seen in the past. But, hot temperatures, depending on what pattern that you get to, can happen at any point during the summer.
And so actually, I want to circle back to something that we were talking about earlier in terms of different groups of people, because we were talking about who is more vulnerable, like based on age and medical condition. But, we should also talk about different types of activities, because people who exercise during extreme heat poses its own risks. People who are want to be out on a boat or in a lake or at a swimming pool. There's all different types of risks that are posed based on the heat. I'm always stunned at the people that I see running at 9, 10 o'clock in the morning on a day when it's 90 degrees out.
Yeah, and, you know, in fact, I went and did my jog at 6 o'clock in this morning to try to beat the heat.
Oh, it was still hot. It was really hot.
It was still hot. It was still hot. It was still humid. But just trying to beat the hottest time of the day and making sure that take as many precautions as possible with that. And there's really multiple ways that we can measure the effects of heat. So we talk a lot about the heat index. And, you know, that's probably the one that people are most familiar with and hear about the most. And that's really a measure of how hot that it feels when relative humidity is factored in with that actual air temperature. So that's one that we look at. Another one that maybe isn't quite as well known to the, you know, people is the wet bulb glow temperature. And so that one uses temperature, humidity, wind, solar radiation, and other weather parameters as well, but it's actually a particularly effective indicator of heat stress for active populations, such as outdoor workers and athletes, as you mentioned, you know, people running. But there's also the National Weather Service Heat Risk that has come out, which is an experimental new product. And this provides a forecast risk of heat-related impacts. So it looks at how significantly above normal the temperatures are at your location, the time of year, the duration of the unusual heat, and if those temperatures are at levels that pose an elevated risk for heat complications. So whenever you see elevated levels for any of these products, it's important to take heat-related precautions. And National Weather Service meteorologists then utilize these tools to issue appropriate watches, warnings, and advisories for the heat.
You know, last year we had to deal with the smoke from the Canadian wildfires, right? And you look out at California, they're already into wildfire season. I wonder, how does smoke and wildfire contribute to the issue of heat domes and heat waves?
So when we talk about ozone and wildfires, what that really affects is air quality across the region. When we've already seen different things with we've seen air quality alerts that have come out in different areas across the Midwest because of some of these aspects with the ozone. Last year, again, with the Canadian wildfires, that was a big thing, was the actual air quality. And you just remember even the visibility with some of that was so reduced due to that. So it really plays a role into the air quality aspects with this.
Yeah, and I think in some ways when it's smoky and it smells burnt and it's hot, it just, like, even if it's not adding to the temperature, it adds to the feel of, like, the world. Like, it just feels hotter in a way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, when you have, like, the light winds, too, you just get that stagnant air over a region as well that keeps that in place.
That was Ashley Novak, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service's Wilmington office here in Ohio. Thank you so much for all of your tips on how to stay safe in the heat dome this week. And I want to say thank you to the All Sides staff, senior producer Marcus Charleston, producer Aaron Esmont Rabinowitz, our intern producers, Abigail Jump and Kira Kadar. Video production is by the Ohio Channel. Board operations is by Chris Johnston and Cameron Howard. And Alan DiCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Our WOSU Radio Chief Content Director is Mike Thompson. 89.7 Program Director is Amy Jurovich. Radio Operations Director, Kevin Petrilla. Senior Broadcast Technician, Dalton Jones. Be sure to like us, All Sides, on Facebook and follow the show on Facebook and on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. And stay safe out there this week. Make sure to drink water, get lots of fluid, take care of your pets, and take care of each other. And make sure to tune in tomorrow. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is sitting down with us to talk the fight for 15 minimum wage here in Ohio, to talk about the economy, to talk about inflation, kitchen table issues, and more. So tune in at 10 a.m. to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.